So
this is a big committee.
So I just got a new nominator this morning.
I only got mine.
The Transportation Committee will come to order. Senator Lori, you're first up with Senate File 2461. I'm going to make an announcement right now. A lot of these schedules, not only for the Transportation Committee, but for all the other committees in the Minnesota Senate, is changing basically on a daily basis. We have rules that state that we have to have our agendas posted so many hours before committee. Now, we did that. And we changed our committee schedule, and we did it for a lot of good reasons. And unfortunately, we had people who thought they were having bills heard today, but the agenda was changed yesterday. You got to watch the website and watch for these changes is all I'm saying, because I don't want our staff to have to field more phone calls like they did today with people who are upset that their bills got moved around. You got to watch the website, and you got to do your job. That's period. We can't do it for you. With that, Senator Lori, Senate File 2461.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess thank you for hearing my bill. Senate File 2461, the Complete Streets Bill. And right off, I have an A3 author's amendment that will take care of the last of the concerns that anybody really had about this bill. So I'd like to go ahead and offer that as an
I'll move the amendment.
Get somebody to offer that as an author's amendment.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the amendment.
Senator Dibble has moved the A3 amendment. As the A3 amendment's being passed out, can you explain what it does?
Yeah, really, there was a piece in the bill that allowed DOT to offer variances to local units of government working on road projects that is different than the current variance committee that meets quarterly, and it was really about administrative simplification, but it did cause some of the county engineers some heartburn, and the coalition, we sat down and worked with them and came up with a compromise that still helps move Complete Streets projects forward and engages local communities in the flexibility that is the goal of the Complete Streets legislation. And as a additional benefit, it also takes out the lion's share of the fiscal note that we got. There is a $50,000 per year cost associated with administering the Department of Transportation variance process that is being removed by this amendment, so that 50 grand is also being removed by this amendment. And that's really what the amendment does.
And Senator Lori, Ms. Pierzowski just says it takes the legislative findings out of the...
Yes, and it also, we put legislative findings in the bill for introduction. We do this frequently to just help the public when they come and search the Senate website. You know, hey, there's a bill. It's nice to have a little paragraph tag to tell them what it's about. But, yes, it also removes the legislative findings piece.
Okay.
Because we don't like to clutter up our red books, session laws, and statute books with the legislative findings. So that does come out.
And Senator Lori, either way on this fiscal note, that's it's such a small number that even if the fiscal note stood, we wouldn't worry about it.
Right.
Okay. And that's not to say that it's not, you know, important, especially looking at the number on the county state aid, but it is a small number. It's distributed across the state.
And I've talked with the department about it. They're willing to absorb this and just work forward, particularly when it's just the reports that are left is the extent of the fiscal note, $10,000 in the first year, $30,000 in the second, and $10,000 in the third year. So that's the extent of the fiscal implications, none of it general fund.
Well, Senator Lori, if you want your testifiers to get some... on the A3 Dibble motion to amend, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, motion does prevail. Senator Olson?
Mr. Chairman, and Senator Lori, if the reports are filed electronically, would it bring that cost down a little more?
I don't know. The Department of Transportation put this together. I don't know exactly how much of it is... for the printing itself. I mean, we could get the department to come up and respond to that if you care to.
But you know, there are probably other ways to even bring that down, is what I'm suggesting.
Yeah, and Senator Lori, Senator Olson, that's part of the underlying bill that we didn't take out. So those reports are filed electronically. It's back on page 3 of the bill,
good,
kind of towards
thank
the
you.
Bottom. Senator Lori, your testifiers.
Yeah, I've got Janelle Waldock with Blue Cross Blue Shield. This is more than a transportation bill, by the way, members. This is a health bill. This is an environment bill. This is a good bill. It's transportation is the main driver, but I do have Janelle Waldock here with Blue Cross Blue Shield. And then I've also got Gary Anger, the principal at Red Pine Elementary from Egan, here too as well, that would like to offer a few statements.
Okay. Ms. Waldock, you want to go first?
Yes, thank you. Chair Murphy and members of the committee, I'm Janelle Waldock. I'm the Prevention Advocacy Director at Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Minnesota, and I'm pleased to be here today to speak in support of Senate File 2461 on behalf of the Complete Streets Coalition. Blue Cross is one of nearly 60 organizations that have come together to support this bill. You're probably not very used to having health companies come before you to comment on transportation policy, so let me say just a bit about Blue Cross's interest in this legislation. We support Complete Streets because, as a health company, we see it as an important strategy to address the rising rates of obesity. Safer roads support increased physical activity and better health by making it easier for people to get around on foot or by bike. But improved community health is really just one benefit of the bill, as Senator Lori said. This bill is about safety. Complete Streets will make roads safer for all users. More kids will be able to walk or bike to school. More seniors will be able to cross roads safely. And more people with disabilities will be able to use the transportation systems. This also provides, this bill provides flexibility for local governments. Right now, there are rigid requirements that kind of make it hard for local communities to design in a way that allows for multiple modes of transportation. And Complete Streets will give communities and everyday people more say in how their communities, how they build roads that work for them and are sensitive to their own local contexts. This issue has brought together a broad range of stakeholders and organizations who all recognize the broad benefits that it will bring. Just to name a few, the coalition includes groups like AARP, the American Heart Association, the Lutheran Coalition for Public Policy in Minnesota, the Minnesota Association of Small Cities, the Minnesota Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities, and the Minnesota Environmental Partnership. Some of us are supporting this bill because it's smart health policy, like Blue Cross. Some of our partners are supporting this bill because it's smart transportation policy, or smart energy policy, or smart public safety policy, or smart economic development policy. Because it brings benefits from all of those perspectives. If adopted, this bill will really build on some terrific work that has happened at the local level on this issue. In the last year alone, three cities and a county have passed their own local Complete Streets ordinances. They include Rochester, the City of St. Paul, Elbert Lee, and Hennepin County. On behalf of the Complete Streets Coalition, I want to thank Senator Lori for his leadership on this issue and you for your time in considering it today, and I encourage you to support the bill.
Well, thank you, Ms. Waldock. Mr. Anger. Oh, Senator Bonhoff, did you have a question?
Mr. Chair, I had a comment, but I didn't even raise my hand. You just knew that I had it.
That's what happens when you give me the look.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Waldock, it's good to see you here.
Nice to see you.
Tomorrow, we have in the Education Committee the bill that our working group on preventing childhood obesity put forward is going to be heard, and that includes the Complete Streets. And so this is a wonderful example of how we're working together in a comprehensive way to affect public policy. And I know that you were part of that effort this summer. And so thank you very much. And thank you, Senator Lori.
Yeah, the schools are a big component. Safe routes to school, walking school buses, getting our communities out and using our thoroughfares is just really critical for building a Minnesota that we can all rely on.
Yeah.
Thank you. Mr. Anger.
Well, thank you also, Senator Murphy and committee members. And Senator Bonhoff, thanks for making the bridge for my sharing here this afternoon. Very natural for me. My name is Gary Anger. I'm the principal at Red Pine Elementary School in Eagan. We serve the communities of Eagan, Rosemont, Invergrove Heights, and Coates at Red Pine Elementary with about 900 students from those communities. So transportation is an important part of what we do every day. I've been an administrator in our Minnesota schools for, this is my 12th year, and an educator for over 20 years. We do have a problem, everyone. More and more kids are overweight and facing obesity issues in our country. Nearly 10 million children and adolescents ages 6 through 19 were considered obese in most recent surveys. And Minnesota's youth are not immune to this problem. Yet more and more parents are dropping their kids off and or picking them up at school in cars, mainly because they don't feel that the streets are safe enough for their kids to walk or bike to school. An example of this was just pointed out yesterday in the Star Tribune's whistleblower blog, and we have copies of that if you would like to see that. A parent and former bus driver felt that the roads were unsafe for his 5-year-old son to travel. And after contacting the Star Tribune's whistleblower unit, the school paid for an additional bus stop to be added closer to their home. When roads are deemed unsafe, school districts end up busing more kids by necessity. And not only is that bad for kids' health, but it also increases education costs for school districts. School officials like myself face these issues every single day. And if funds for busing are ever reduced or eliminated, we need to be more thinking as a state and take steps now to make our streets safe for our youth to walk or bike to school. And complete streets is a common sense solution. Not only does this solution increase physical activity to help combat obesity, it's also been proven to benefit learning. A study last February in the issue of Pediatrics found that routinely providing students with time for recess can improve their behavior and academic performance in the classroom. Similar studies have been done in the Journal of School Health and many other publications. So with limited resources, we at Red Pine set out to do something about this problem several years ago. Being able to walk or bike to school is a great way to build physical activity and also social activity for students and their parents into the daily routine without impacting school budgets. But of course, safety is an issue. Schools like Red Pine have been successful in reducing traffic while increasing the number of bikers and walkers. As a matter of fact, at Red Pine, over the past 2 years, with some of the programming we've done, we've increased the percentage of bikers and walkers by 40% while reducing carpool traffic by over 25% at our school. But it's been really hard work. We've had a Safe Routes to School grant in place. We've used SHIP funds, and thank you very much for that, and a very tight Blue Cross Blue Shield partnership. The result has been such things at our school as walking school buses, walk and bike to school day, neighborhood signage, a Safe Routes map on our website, a safe travel plan that we've established at our school, and other great resources to encourage families to walk or bike to school. Even with this success, barriers remain primarily in the road infrastructure that we have to deal with at Red Pine. County Road Highway 3 runs right near our school, and it's just really hard to deal with that barrier, and many schools have these similar barriers. But complete streets will steer municipalities in the right direction in getting more people walking, biking, and to help other schools do what we've done at Red Pine. So I fully support the Complete Streets legislation and ask that you also strongly consider it.
Thank you, Mr. Anger. Mr. Anger, I think you touched on a couple things that are really important. You know, as we move forward and start building new roads and open up new corridors or expand existing roadways, you know, looking 20 or 30 years down the road, not only in the transportation sector, but what that corridor, what is in that corridor and what potentially could be in that corridor, like a new school or a medical center or whatever, just makes sense. I mean, it just makes sense because if we can build it now, we're going to save hundreds of millions of dollars down the road. You know, Senator Laurie, I'm glad that you and you know, the folks that have brought this forward kind of work some of the things out with the county engineers. I know that they have a very high standard. They want to keep their very high standard, but I think what you worked out was a mechanism so that, you know, if those high standards were overly burdensome and, you know, there's a way to get a variance from some of those. They're put in place for a very good reason. I think that Minnesota has proven that we've got a falling fatality rate. It was like 20% less this year from the previous year. We're moving in the right direction. We don't want to upset that apple cart. But on the same time, the same hand, we want to make sure that the Complete Streets program is one that's going to be viable well into the future. So
right.
This is a good bill.
I agree. If I could just close in while opening up for questions, too, I think you bring up a really good point, and that is how I frame it, is that we're really talking about when we're going to make a public investment in road infrastructure. We really should pause to think about all of the uses that this corridor is going to need to be utilized for 20 or 30 years. We owe it to the people of Minnesota to be thoughtful about our investments and make sure that they'll be able to reap those benefits over those decades long that investment will be there trying to serve that community. And retrofits like the extra bus stop is a very expensive way to go about this thought process. If we wait for tragedy and spend the money to do the retrofits, it's a much less efficient use of our public dollars than if we pause for a minute before the investments and think about all of the uses. And I think that our local communities, if given the power to use that flexibility, will use it wisely and make a much better investments with our scarce resources.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I don't have a question, just a quick comment, and I'm ready to move the bill when the time comes, or if the time is upon us. I'm ready to move the bill. I just wanted to mention that, I have some experience in this arena. Back when I was the aide to a city council member, there was a proposal to redesign one of the county highways that goes right through the heart of my district, what is now my district. I was then just a semi-regular citizen, it was in a fully built South Minneapolis neighborhood, residential mostly, with some neighborhood nodes, commercial nodes, and the state aid standards dictated a significant amount of widening, which would have taken down all the mature trees, significantly narrowed the boulevards, significantly impacted the quality of life along the street, the ability of people to cross it, kids to cross it. It's Lindale Avenue South, and so, of course, the neighborhoods on the other side are wanting to cross it to get to Lake Harriet and other places. There's a school on the other side. Crossing it, moving along it would have been really hard. And I think the impact, if that had prevailed on the quality of the housing stock as well as the viability of those commercial nodes, would have been significantly hampered. So while this bill focuses a lot on, all the different types of users that are going to be moving up and down the street, I think the real positive effect is the land use, is the quality of life for residents and businesses and schools and other sorts of uses along the street. So that's what attracts me to this bill. What I also really like is the fact that, it's not some kind of kooky pie in the sky. It talks about adherence to the AASHTO guidelines, the American Association of State Highway and Transportation Officials, well-researched gold standard traffic engineering guidelines. So I think it's also kind of takes a go slow approach, a pilot project. Let's look at this. Let's make sure it works. Let's work with the locals in a way that they can support. So I think it's an intelligent approach to kind of starting to move down this path, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Carlson.
And I'd like to add to Senator Dibble's comments, Mr. Chair. I'm glad to see Principal Anger be here, and of course also Mrs. Mayer too from Egan. But this is about vision, and in schools we try to teach vision. It's difficult to legislate vision, but this probably comes as close to legislating vision as you could possibly get. And this is where we're encouraging the kind of look out into the future, just what could happen. And we've got a lot of examples here, and I sometimes think we've lost our vision that created the interstate system, for instance. But now something like this can help us just have that little reminder, that conscience on our shoulder, to look out into the future and how are these roadways going to be used and how can we put together policies that accommodate that kind of vision. So this is really great. I really appreciate you bringing it, Senator Laurie. Strong supporter of it.
Further comment from the committee? Senator Dibble has moved that Senate File 2461, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Senate floor. I'm sorry, it has to go to full finance, Senator Laurie.
hey, I liked your first motion.
I did, too, because I'm not too worried about the fiscal note on this, but it does need to go to finance, so the motion will be to go to finance. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. Thank you, Senator Laurie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Member.
Now we'll enter the extended portion of our meeting here. Senator Murphy, Senate File 2741, Driving While Impaired. Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Senate File 2741 is a legislative initiative that the governor's office kicked off. And there's several people here with the Department of Public Safety today to help us walk through the bill. There's several other testifiers to give their opinions, you know, from the perspective of the Mothers Against Drunk Driving and also the perspective of public defenders. You know, I made a comment earlier about there's been a 20% reduction in the overall fatalities on our roads from 1 year to the next, and we all should celebrate that. We all should be very happy that that has occurred and continue to do the hard work to make that number continue to tumble. This is part of that hard work. You know, still we still have 20-25% of everybody that's involved in a fatal accident. There's an alcohol component there. Now, if we can erase that and make that zero, hopefully those folks will have their lives saved as well. I feel very strongly that this plan that was approved by the governor and built by Ms. Marty and a lot of the folks in her office, I'm very enthusiastic that this bill is going to help take the next step towards curbing drunk driving on our roads. This bill is the carrot and the stick approach. And the stick may seem a little harsh in places, but we have to remember that drunk driving is a very harsh penalty to those families who get hit by drunk drivers and lose a family member. That's probably the harshest form of punishment any family needs to go through. The carrot part of it is that we do recognize that there are folks who can be gotten to with treatment and rehabilitative services, and the department is kind of on the front line here to use a portion of that, which is this Interlock program, to make sure that those people who have violated the law can continue to go to work, provide for their families, pay their health care insurance, get the kids to school, and, you know, they're still mobile, they're still part of the family. I think that that's a huge step forward. And if people decide to go into the program, you know, not only are they getting the help with the Interlock so that they don't get behind the wheel after drinking, but there's also that component there that they have recognized what they have done is wrong and they're trying to make the appropriate restitution. I mean, I think everybody can understand, you know, that every now and again people make a mistake, and they may have had one or two too many drinks, and then they get on the road. You know, I've always been pretty hardline, where I think that everybody should lose their license for at least a year if you get a DWI, and you should be mandatory treatment, you know, a 28-day program, right on down the line, because you chose to do that. It's an activity you chose to do. But in today's society, if we did that with everybody, our prisons would be, there would be people falling out the windows, and we just can't do that and tear the prisons apart any more than what they've been torn apart. Now, I'm going to, who wants to go first here? Okay, Tim's going to go first. I'm going to let the authorities behind alcohol enforcement speak first towards the bill. But I can tell you, on those people who have, you know, their fourth, fifth, sixth, eighth DWI, I think that we should have a standard that's even stronger than is proposed in this bill. So I would hope that folks kind of leave that part of it alone, because unless you want to make it stronger, not weaker. If you want to put people in jail for up to a year, mandatory, I can go along with that. But I'm going to let Mr. Leslie take over here. He's the Assistant Commissioner for the Department of Public Safety and has been in law enforcement for, what, 30?
Yeah, up to 30 now.
30 years
close
now?
Close to 30.
Okay.
Mr. Leslie, please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tim Leslie, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Public Safety. Good afternoon. This is a high priority for the Governor of the Department of Public Safety. We think it really makes a lot of sense. The bill is the result of the work of 60 stakeholders meeting and brainstorming for the past year and a half. The goal is clearly compelling and right in front of us, as clearly stated by the Senator. It's to create stronger administrative sanctions that will decrease alcohol-related crashes with fatalities and serious injuries and increase legal driving of DUI by DUI offenders. The bill requires that ignition interlock be installed on all first-time DUI offenders' vehicles who've had alcohol concentrations of less than 0.15 for a period of 6 months. For those multiple DUI offenders, ignition interlock could remain on their vehicles for up to 6 years. Ignition interlock is a tool that's proven to be very effective in reducing impaired driving while installed on vehicles. It's a technology that we should embrace and use when drivers have demonstrated their behavior that risks people's lives on our roadways. This requirement does include first-time DUI offenders. The evidence is crystal clear. 80% of drinking drivers involved in a fatal crash or arrested for DWI had either no or one prior DWI on their record. Ignoring those first-time offenders greatly decreases the effectiveness of this legislation. The legislation also provides a pathway for all DUI offenders to become legal drivers in 15 to 30 days. Currently, an epidemic of illegal driving exists with over 40,000 convictions annually for this type of behavior. This is a good bill. It provides for both public safety on our roadways and legal driving opportunities for DUI offenders. It really does benefit everyone, and I hope for your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Leslie. And Senator Murphy, did you have any more comments, or you want to go to your next testifier?
No, we can go to Ms. Marty.
Ms. Marty, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Cherie Marty. I'm the Director of the Office of Traffic Safety with the Department of Public Safety, and we are very pleased to present our bill to you today. I think that both the Senator, as Senator Murphy, as well as Assistant Commissioner Leslie, have really adequately covered why this bill is important. And what I'd like to do is just emphasize one point, and that is what we're here to do is to talk about improvements to administrative sanctions. And administrative sanctions are not about punishing the offender. It is about protecting the public. and the Department of Public Safety's role in ensuring that the public is safe on our roadways. So what we are here today is to talk about a bill that can separate the very dangerous practice of drinking and driving, and separating that drinking driver from a very dangerous weapon, which could be their vehicle. So if we could turn to your handout, I'm just going to walk through that. The goals of the proposal, I think we've touched on this very adequately. So just very briefly, again, it's about safeguarding the public by strengthening our sanctions as well as more effectively using proven technology, and that would be expanding the use of ignition interlock. Secondly, it is a means for DWI offenders to drive with a valid license. We continuously get calls to our agency from your constituents saying that I've got a member of my community who literally cannot drive to work, cannot drive to their doctor's appointments. They can't drive. They have no option of driving, and sometimes that's up to 7 years of not having an option of legally driving. This bill provides you that option, and it is a pathway to legal driving. And then finally, promote successful rehabilitation. We have been able to put the best minds of treatment and rehabilitation to this proposal to guide us in how we can best use administrative sanctions to work with an offender who's trying to get their life in order and get themselves back on sobriety and be productive in society. And this proposal does that. If we could turn to the next page, which would be the key components of our proposal. There are four cornerstones. The first one we've already talked quite a bit about, which it would be the use of ignition interlock. Simply put, an offender either can drive legally with full driving privileges on ignition interlock, or they can choose to not drive for their revocation period. That's it. So we recognize that driving is a privilege, not a right, and we're giving them back that privilege after their abuse, but we're also protecting the public. And we believe that this bill is both strong and firm on drunk drivers, as well as being compassionate to the needs that they have to live in society. The second cornerstone is DL sanctions would be enhanced for the first-time offenders at 0.15 alcohol concentration level rather than 0.20. Minnesota is in a top tier of states that have the highest alcohol concentration level. We are one of five states that have enhancements at 0.20. All the research, all the data is overwhelmingly supportive that the problem doesn't start a big time problem at 0.20, it starts at 0.15. So we want to get in line with most of the other states that are under 0.20. The third cornerstone is restructuring reinstatement requirements for chronic DWI offenders. What we recognize is that ignition interlock is a very strong device that monitors their drinking and driving patterns, and we want to separate that. So this clearly does that, and currently our sanctions are out of step by simply saying people can't drive for up to 7 years. That's just not workable. And then finally, we do capitalize on the successes that we're learning with our current statewide ignition interlock program. What we bring to you today is not necessarily a new proposal. We've been talking to you for the last 2 years about ignition interlock. You did vote to expand our two-county ignition interlock program statewide last year. It's been extremely successful. We have 700 offenders on ignition interlock, and of those 700, only one have reoffended. So with that, I'd like to jump to the last page, and then we can go back to the blue tables, because that'll bring us into a level of detail. But let me just talk about the benefits. And so first, we have strong benefits to the public. Clearly, we are creating roadways that are safer because we are using ignition interlock. And again, we're separating that unsafe driver from getting into a vehicle and potentially using that vehicle as a deadly weapon to create serious bodily harm and oftentimes fatality. Secondly, we believe that this protects the public more strongly than existing sanctions. and third, the societal costs associated with impaired driving. Serious injuries don't always make the headlines. We recognize that the medical, emotional, physical costs are often lifelong and incalculable. It's just astronomical, the costs to society, and this bill goes a long way to curb that. There are clear benefits to the DWI offender, as we've already talked. After a short no-driving period of 15 to 30 days, we give them full driving privileges. Third, we've talked about how this is a very useful device in working with their treatment program and helping them modify their behavior change. There are clear benefits to the state. The offenders pay the cost of the program, which is about $100 a month. That's about $3 a day or one beer. We do address the epidemic of people driving illegally without a valid license. Currently, we have about 40,000 convicted drivers each year that are driving without a valid license. And then finally, we diminish the probability and possibility of repeat DWI dramatically. We can really spare Minnesota the embarrassment and the tragic consequences of these multiple offenders getting their 8th, their 12th, even their 20th DWI. We feel that we are targeting the behavior of drinking and driving and not going beyond that. And clearly, that should never happen again. We'll never see that 20th DWI. So those are the benefits, and we really, those are the cornerstones of the program and our bill. If you turn back to the blue matrix, and you've got essentially, we've outlined what our current system of sanctions are, and then we have our proposed sanctions. And what you'll notice in each, whether you're, we'll just look at the first and second time offenders, you have a short period of no driving privileges, followed by either 6 months for a first time offender of full driving privileges with ignition interlock, or you sit out that and not drive and your license is revoked. So you've got that kind of pattern throughout each of these offenses. If you turn to the page and you've got your hardcore third-time offenders and so on, those that are chronic offenders, these are individuals that are canceled as inimical to public safety. They're high risk, and it is in the state's interest to surgically separate that high-risk drinking driver from the public. So we do that through, again, you'll have no more than a 30-day period of no driving privileges. And then we would move into and graduate them on receiving their full privileges with a one-year limited license on ignition interlock, allowing them to get to work, AA, treatment, probation, doctor's office, taking their kids to school. And then after that 1 year of limited license on ignition interlock, they will have full driving privileges and being able to take their family and friends wherever they need to go. So that's pretty much it. And you've got a graduated amount of time depending on the number of offenses.
So, Mr. Chairman.
So with that concludes what I had to say. I'm certainly open to any questions. And then we do have one more testifier.
Thank you, Ms. Marty. Questions from the committee? Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Ms. Marty, I was glad to hear you talk about the successes of the pilot program. I know the folks in Beltrami County are concerned if they weren't able to continue what they're currently doing under the pilot program because they have had such positive results. Now, they got a small grant to start that. But I guess the question I have, and maybe Senator Murphy, is this a positive is this a cost or a savings to the state if this is to become implemented? Has anybody done a fiscal look at this?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Murphy.
And Senator Skoy, Ms. McCormick from the Division of Vehicle Services is with us to speak about the overall cost.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. McCormick. Please state your name and continue with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Pat McCormick, the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services with the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. And Ms. Marty stated earlier, we are currently administering an ignition interlock program right now. And as part of that program, we do have one staff member that's being paid for by the grant that we have received through the Office of Traffic Safety. But if we look at this long term in terms of it being operational within our division, as most of you must know, we do handle driver compliance, and we have 13 staff members that serve as driver evaluators. And those are the individuals who they write limited licenses right now. They meet with people, offenders, in terms of doing administrative reviews. They also work on explaining privileges for drivers who have driver license suspensions or revocations. And currently, they do approximately 228 limited license interviews per week, approximately 95 hours per week. Because of the changes that are being proposed in this legislation, where you would not be limiting or issuing limited licenses for first and second violations, that would usually take at least 30 minutes for each of those people. That's almost 80% of the evaluation activity in terms of DWI violations, which is just one part of driver compliance, would be taken care of. And so we believe that we would be able to handle the activities involved with the ignition interlock rather than doing the duties they're currently doing with issuing limited licenses. They would still have we would still have the capability of doing the administration part of that versus the issuing limited licenses. So we believe that we would be able to handle this without any fiscal impact.
Very good. Thank you.
Senator Olson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions, one relating to your chart here. You're talking about options, but on several of these you have plate impoundment. Does the plate impoundment go along with you don't want to take their plates away if you're going to let them drive. So what does that apply to?
Ms. Marty.
Yeah, we just wanted to, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the plane impoundment is just remains the same, so that actually hasn't changed, except for we would not, for a first-time offender, would not have a plate impoundment, but for a first-time offender at a higher AC level, which would be now in our proposal at 0.15 versus 0.20, they would have their plate impounded.
So, Mr. Chair.
Senator Olson.
Could you explain that to me? Because if you've taken away their license plates, then how can you drive with an interlock system?
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, when you take away your regular Minnesota plates, but we do have the W, you know, the what some people call the whiskey plates, the W-lettered plates, and those you would be able to get. It just designates the fact that you're driving and you have this you've either had an enhancement or because you have multiple violations, your regular license plates are impounded for that period of time.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chair,
Senator Olson.
Then the other aspect of if this goes into effect as it is, does this apply to people that are currently under some of these sentences, that they would now have this option that they didn't have before, or is it only for new infractions?
Ms. Marty.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we have discussed this, and we felt that these people would have the option. So any time that they've already served as part of their revocation period would apply.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And question for either of you. The notion of multiple cars, it says in the bill that you have to provide an interlock for each car you intend to drive. How do you oversee that?
Mr. Chair and members, what we're requiring is that any car that offender plans to drive will need to have the ignition interlock system on that vehicle. So if that individual is planning to drive three vehicles, it would have to have the system on three vehicles. But most offenders, and we have not had an issue with this in our pilot program, they select the car that they're going to drive, and that's the car that has the ignition interlock system on it.
Any other questions from the committee? Senator Kielash.
Mr. Chair, Senator Murphy, I'm not sure who could answer this, but I'm kind of curious what happens if they're driving for a living, for example, driving truck or deliveries or et cetera, and how does that handle in this bill?
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Senator Kielash, what we're talking about doing would be adding an amendment that would allow for a type of variance process where, as part of the employment duties, if a participant must drive an employer-owned vehicle that doesn't have an ignition interlock, then we would have to meet with that employer and discuss the conditions and have a variance to the current process that is part of this law. So we would add an allowance to do a variance. Now, we would write those into the program. The variance process would be written into our program guidelines that are discussed in the bill. But we would have to make sure that the employer understood what the duties would be if this person, if the fact that we would be ensuring that the employer is basically supervising and understands the liabilities that he or she may be taking on by having a person who's in this status driving a vehicle for their employment. But we think we can work it out, and because of the complexity with the various types of occupations, we think probably doing it on a one-on-one basis with an employer and a driver is the way to go. It's very similar to the types of variances we do with driver's licenses right now in terms of different kinds of identification that are needed to get to your driver's license. So we would try to work on a case-by-case basis. But the employer would have to know that this person was a participant in this program and understand that they have this on their record. So the only people that would not be allowed to do that would be commercial drivers, and those people are excluded from this program. This only involves people driving a Class D license, not a commercial driver's license.
Thank you.
Senator Kielash.
Just curious as to, will this bill have any savings for the state because we're not doing what we're currently doing? Is there any potential there?
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Senator, I think DVS is a fee-based system, and as you know, on a biennial basis, the department reviews its operations and the programs it administers, and I think certainly if we found that there was savings, then we'd try to reflect that in the fees that we look at every 2 years. So I think that would certainly be something we would be looking at, and I'm sure the Office of Traffic Safety, the department in general, we would be bringing forward to our commissioner.
Senator Olsen, did you have a question?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I'm a co-author on the bill, and I'm very supportive of it. I do have some questions that I'd like to ask. Number one, I guess, would be the effect on counties and court systems with because there's going to be probation officers, I suspect, and impact at the county level and in the court system. Do you have any numbers on that?
Ms. Marty.
Mr. Chair and members, because this is only on the administrative sanction side of this, there are no added costs. Ms. McCormick has already spoke to what our agency is able to absorb in monitoring this program with existing resources. So there is no added cost to this for the courts. I mean, this is really just on the administrative side of this problem that we have.
General team.
Good point.
Do we have data on how many first-time offenders come back in the overall picture of DWI offenses? Is there data on how many first-time offenders reoffend, the percentage or whatever?
Ms. Marty.
Mr. Chair and Senator Olsen, the data that we have is, as Commissioner Leslie mentioned, of all the DWI fatalities, 60% are those that have never had a DWI. Of those that are arrested for the first time for DWI, 40% will return and reoffend. That's a very significant number, which is why it's so important that we do target the first and all offenders.
I have just a couple more, if I may, Mr. Chair.
I believe, Senator Scoy, did you want to make a point on that?
Well, Mr. Mm-hmm. Chair and Senator Olsen, maybe they could help me here. I know you're MnDOT, so you probably don't address this, but wouldn't there be significant costs and less jail time for some of these offenders? Savings, I mean?
Ms. McCormick?
Mr. Chair and Senator Scoy, that would only involve the criminal side of the DWI process. It wouldn't involve anything that Driver and Vehicle Services and the department does. That is decided through the court system if there would be any jail time involved. We're talking just about the administrative side, losing your license, and then eventually getting it reinstated when you've met all the statutory requirements.
Senator Scoy, did you have a follow-up?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Olsen, we hadn't.
On that point, Mr. Chair.
Senator Bond.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Ms. Marty or Ms. McCormick, I'm a little bit confused. So who administers the ignition interlock system? Do they come in to you all and you check the systems, or are there who administers, because the period are long, so who administers that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Moi, our driver compliance office gets reports from the vendor for those vehicles that have the ignition interlock program or the ignition interlock device on that program. And then we get a monthly report, and we review those. And if we see that there are any reflections of the fact that they were not able to meet the standards, then we can call them into our office or meet with them and discuss those concerns, and we would have to determine whether there was a glitch in the system or whatever, but our staff work through that with the vendor. And the program right now, I'm not sure how many vendors we're working with, but
we're currently,
go ahead, four vendors. And so we would be working with them in order to ensure that they're operating safely and not drinking and driving.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, so on this point, so how many people, given the number of people we're looking at, how many people are going to be going to these vendors, and how many of these reads are going to be coming into your office for you to review on a monthly basis?
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Senator Moi, right now we have over 700 participants, and we have one person that's administering that program. But we have 13 driver evaluators, and if we were talking about bringing people in to look at, to discuss the reports with them, and we've only had one that has been a problem as part of this program, then it would be one of those driver evaluators, because we wouldn't be doing the issuing of limited licenses that we're currently doing, which takes up an enormous amount of our driver evaluators' time. And 80% of the limited licenses we issue are for first and second time offenders, which would be the majority of people that we believe would be participating in the program. Hmm.
Senator Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And whoever might have the answer to this question, has there been any evaluation of the pilot programs in the two counties? And then you said we did send it statewide this past year. Do we have any evidence of reduction, even in that time span of time, of reoffense by first-time offenders, for example, or later? We were talking about the issue of jail time, and I'm not sure at what offense that the courts can start to apply jail time. But that's, if we can stop it, obviously, if we can slow that down or stop it earlier by this technique, then obviously, if they don't go beyond that, there will be a savings in the court and jail costs. But do you have any evidence to that with what we've been doing thus far?
Ms. Marty. Yeah.
Mr. Chair and members, what we have clearly seen that with the 700 participants on it, it's been very effective. We believe that if we have a strong program in Minnesota, that will act as a strong deterrent for your average person like myself, who might think twice about having that second glass of third glass of wine. And it really will serve as a deterrent, and the research shows that it does serve as a deterrent in states that have a strong ignition interlock program. So we would expect that we would see far fewer offenses.
Thank you.
Senator Perry.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Ms. McCormick, I've got a couple of questions. How do you respond to the statement from the American Probation and Parole Association's estimate that this will cost Minnesota over $11 million to enforce, and that's based on, they say here, $3 per day to monitor?
Ms. Marty.
Mr. Chair and members, That figure, the $11 million that I believe it was either New Mexico or that Arizona that had experienced that increase in costs, that's because that was a court-administered program, and that probation was monitoring these offenders. And it was the probation costs of monitoring ignition interlock that was the $11 million. What we're proposing is that we are able to use existing staff within driver and vehicle services to do the monitoring. Therefore, there would be no fiscal impact.
Senator Perry.
Mr. Chair, Senator Murphy, it's a quick question. Of course, you know, I've investigated many fatal accidents in my time on police and sheriff's departments, but has there been anything done? And obviously, I'll be the first one to say I think we're a little too lenient here. That's I have a reason for that. But has there been any research done on what really is the biggest deterrent for not wanting to drink and drive? And I only bring this up because in those that I have arrested for DWI, and of course this was years ago when I was younger, when I would see them again, they would say the biggest thing that hurt them was losing the privilege to drive and the embarrassment. Mm-hmm. Is that still the case?
Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Perry, you hit on an important part. Yes, that's still the case. The embarrassment and the administrative sanctions are the ones that have the most impact. I mean, that's proven time and time again. These programs, wherever they're at, have...
Senator Murphy, could you pull your mic a little bit closer?
These programs in the states where they've been instituted have shown to be successful. You know, getting it, getting at this issue is difficult, as you know. I mean, the people that are going to repeat 4, 5, 12, 28 times, they have some real problems, and they belong in a treatment facility slash jail. And that's just my opinion. But we're not talking about some of those people here. We're trying about, you know, we're going to try to head that off with this program. But in those areas, it's been very successful. And there's 44 states that currently have these administrative sanctions for these DWI offenders. You know, it's, you know, working with the, Senator Dibble's not here. Senator Dibble chairs the Transportation Committee for NCSL. And this has been an issue not only with that committee but several others on a nationwide issue. And I just know that their committee have been dealing with the DWI issue, and this is one of the things that works outside of just absolutely not letting anybody drive ever again, which is kind of hard for, you know, first, second time offenders.
Senator Perry.
Mr. Chair, one last comment here. I guess the reason I feel this is lenient is because there's so many steps. And, you know, I have arrested the guy that's had 5 DWIs. But if the deterrent is that the loss of license and the embarrassment, in my mind, and then I'll be quiet here, it would be easier for us to have one set of rules. First time, you're somewhat lucky. Here's the leniency, but you come back. And it's like Judge Jerry Wolf in Steele County said, or Rice County, if you come back in front of me again, you're going to get the full extent of the law rather than the steps. That's me personally talking from the guy that's had to inform parents of the death or loss of a loved one because of this. But that's all I have to say.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Senator
and Senator Perry, I don't know if you were here at my opening statement. I mean, if it was up to me, the sanctions would be much stiffer than are in this bill. I kind of look at it the way you do. But, you know, once we step back into reality, there's a lot of family obligations that need to be met inside this, you know, inside the perpetrator's life. And whether it's an obligation to get the kids to school, to the doctor, or get back and forth to work, you know, we want to maintain, or we want to make sure that the family has that opportunity to earn a paycheck. So the worst thing you can do is disqualify them from work because they can't get back and forth, and then have them land on another state-supported system. I mean, that drives up the cost in other areas. I think this is a very fair approach. And the other thing I do believe that it does is that, you know, once you do get to that number 5, it's time to do something serious.
So Mr. Chair.
Ms. Marty, I have a question for you. In this this pilot program, did you see any change in the rate of conviction, being that if there's a large penalty, for instance, loss of driving privilege, increased insurance cost, you know, getting it onto your driver's record, it seems like all too often these are pled down to careless driving. And if there's at least you're not facing loss of driving privilege, some people may be a little less apt to hire an expensive lawyer and plead it down to careless driving. So I'm wondering if you've seen any change in the rate.
Mr. Chair and members, there most certainly has been a change in that every participant in the Ignition Interlock program did not go on to reoffend, so except for one.
And Ms. Marty, I'm specifically thinking of how many people fight a conviction, the first one. Do you see more people that might plead? Ms. Marty.
Mr. Chair and members, we don't have that data of how many people, I mean, that's court information, so how many folks are actually bringing this and pleading to the court and trying to plead this down. We don't have that data. That would be court information. I will say that, you know, there was the earlier question about the cost to the courts, and I did want to just come back to that for a moment. Right now in Minnesota, we do have an epidemic of illegal driving, and all of those driving after withdrawal charges go to the court. So that's 40,000. We have 40,000 convictions each year. That's the court's role in having to prosecute those charges. Well, if we have ignition interlock and we're now giving offenders a means to drive legally, which we currently don't do for many of them, we would see a reduction. We would anticipate a reduction in the driving after withdrawal charges that do end up their way in the courts and logging and just bogging down the court system with all those cases.
Senator Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Murphy, I'm a strong supporter of this bill. The Hennepin County courts did invite some of us during the summer to go and visit with them and hear about their results and actually to watch court. And it was quite impressive, the relationship the judges had with the offenders and the offenders telling their story of how they were making progress in their sobriety, and the offenders actually testifying that what made the difference was being part of this program. And this is something that I've been investigating over the years since I've been a senator, and I'm very pleased that we're doing this right now. And I think I know you've mentioned it in the material you gave us, but I think it's worth saying on the record that the fact the Star Tribune is doing this story smashed on the front page, and it's happening over and over and over to let the public know the consequences of driving drunk and the devastation it's having on our families. You know, the public is saying, please do something. And so I'm glad that we're responding with this.
Mr. Chairman. Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, I just was thinking about what Senator Perry was talking about earlier in terms of the, you know, the deterrent of the humiliation. When you are there sanctions? I found one thing that it's a misdemeanor if you're caught. You've got a restricted license and you're caught driving without that interlock system, so it would be in another vehicle. But what about if people are using the interlock and yet is that so tight that there's no alcohol at all on the breath that's allowed? Mm-hmm. And what if they do have alcohol in the breath? Does that communicated somewhere, or it doesn't stop them so that? And if there were several incidents of that when they weren't supposed to be drinking at all, is there a sanction at that point? So, I mean, do they know that they will face a risk of that humiliation when they've had a chance to, you know, look after their responsibilities with their family and all, or how does that work?
Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, you touch on an important part. You know, there are sometimes false positives from, like, mouthwash or something like that. But there will be a training component on the front end of this where the people who are contracted to provide the device for the individual will have to sit down and say, okay, if you get in your car after you just got done brushing your teeth and, you know, hammering the scope or Listerine or whatever, and you get in, you do your blow, and it won't go, to, you know, just relax, wait a few minutes, you know, maybe walk around a little bit. They'll give you a little bit of training on what to do, and then you get back in the vehicle and you try again. Most of the time, those are just, you know, they go away in, you know, in just a matter of a few minutes. Now, there are other penalties if you continue to blow and continue to rack up, and I'll let Ms. Marty talk about that. But
Ms. Marty.
Mr. Chair and members, if the offender, and we'll talk about first and second time offenders, if they are blowing into the device and their alcohol register is above that device threshold, What we allow for first and second time offenders is that we are requiring no test fails within the last 3 months of the period that they're on the device. So prior to that, let's say you have the device for 6 months for a first time offender. The first 3 months, nothing happens. Okay, it's not considered a violation. But in the last 3 months, if there is a test fail, we're asking them to extend their period so that they have 3 months of no test fails on the device. Does that answer your question for that?
Senator Olson.
Yes, thank you. And Mr. Chair, that, and Ms. Marty, that is at $100 a month pop. Doesn't it cost them $100 a month for this instrument?
Yes.
So there is an ongoing financial obligation for having this freedom. And they perhaps be smart not to abuse it.
Ms. Marty.
Mr. Chair and members, Senator Olson, I like the way you said freedom, because driving is a privilege, it's not a right. And so when you have offended, in order to regain full driving privileges, it will cost you $100 a month.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman.
Senator Murphy.
I apologize for the hootenanny going on upstairs, but, sorry.
Mr. Chairman, anyway, did you orchestrate that, or why are you apologizing for it?
Well, because I can barely hear you when you talk, Senator Olson, sometimes. But to your point, Senator Olson, the other thing that this is going to save is actually saves the individual some money if they don't have to be run through the court system. So you're saving those costs. Granted, you got to pay $100 for the device, but once again, you're back on the road, you're back to work, and you're probably not going to have to end up in court and accumulate a lot of that. That's where the majority of the financial obligation comes from the perpetrator.
We have questions from Olson, Dahl, Sieben, and Ortman.
And Mr.
Senator
Chairman,
Olson.
There are still two people that would like to testify.
Two more
people? There's still two folks that want to testify.
All right, thank you.
Yes.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And I think Ms. Martini addressed it, because I just wanted to say one of the big reasons I support this bill is because we've heard so many times in this committee that somebody will just go out and buy a car with 11 months worth of tabs on it and they're driving illegally. So this gives people the opportunity to do the right thing and to drive legally, and so I really appreciate that, and you had a good answer for that. So,
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think my question was answered, but I'm looking at the penalty phase. If they, if you are in your a family situation and you've got more than one car, you're only going to have this device on one vehicle, and your likelihood of maybe once in a while using the other vehicle, and I'd see it, so there's a penalty in there, but seems to me that if someone's been in, maybe in their first time they've been an offender, they're not likely to press it a little bit. But after they've had their third or fourth offense, possibly, their likelihood of their addiction to that drinking pushes them to the point where, they're going to do things that they shouldn't do. And adding an extra 180 days on for a violation of not, meeting the statute here seems to be a little bit weak. It seems like that would be, you want to have a stiffer penalty. If it's only a one-year revocation, you can only add 6 months onto it if they violate it. And 6 months isn't that much more, it seems to me. But just something for consideration that if there's going to be penalties, they don't, abide by this program, that we should stiffen that part of the statute.
Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dahl, thank you. And we will take that into consideration and look at maybe doing a few of those penalties a little differently. I know that once we go to Senator Moss' committee, if we make it out of here, I'm confident we're making it out of here. But once we get to Senator Moss' committee, she has a whole list of things in regards to the penalty and the sanctions and civil and criminal that we're going to go through, and we'll address those then, if that's okay.
Okay, thanks.
Are you on that committee, Senator Dahl?
Nope.
You're not an attorney? Don't
Sorry.
Want to be an attorney?
You're just going to get me this one time around, Senator Murphy.
Okay.
Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Murphy, or
Ms. Marty, maybe you can answer this. So the offender pays the $100 per month program costs, and I'm curious about how that $100 breaks down. Like, what percent goes to the, are you giving to the contractor to pay for the interlock system, and what percentage comes back to the department for some of the incidental costs, or shaking your head, it all goes, does it all go to the contractor?
Yeah. Mr. Chair and members.
Mrs. Marty.
This is, that's a fee that's paid to the vendor. So the vendor is managing this. So there's no portion of that fee that goes to the department. That's a vendor base to pay their costs in providing this service. So that $100 includes installation. It includes that monthly calibration. It also includes removal and any... So it's the managing of that device.
Matt and Mr. Senator Chair, and in response to that, I just question whether you're getting the best deal possible from these vendors then. If they're capturing the entire cost of the program, it would seem like, and you're getting multiple vendors who are interested in it, if they're making money off of this, because I assume that's why they're providing the service, perhaps we should try to drive a little harder bargain and let the department recover at least a portion of the cost.
Ms. McCormick?
Mr. Chair and Senator Sieben, I think the DVS gets a portion of the DWI reinstatement fee, and that fee is used to help pay for our driver compliance staff as well as the reinstatement fees that we receive. That's how we pay for our staff. And as I was saying previously, we believe right now that we have enough resources to be able to cover the program initially, but obviously, we'd have to be looking at, as we do every 2 years, we evaluate the needs and what staff we have to cover. We also believe that we have been creating some efficiencies, and we're hopeful that as we get our MNLARS system in place, that we may create more efficiencies that may help us where a lot of things that we're doing manually at this time we may not have to do, and so that we would be able to defer those resources to this program if it's successful.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up, if the DWI reinstatement fee that you're getting paid now, however, to pay for those, won't that number drop if this system is implemented, because people aren't paying those costs if they're in this program, or they still would at the end of it?
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Senator Sieben, in order to get into the Ignition Interlock program, they have to pass a DWI test that we give to anyone when they're getting reinstated. They have to get a brand new driver's license, and that's $24, and then they have to pay a $680 reinstatement fee, and a portion of that fee comes to DVS to pay for driver compliance. So they still would have to pay those fees up front before they'd begin to participate in the program.
And Mr. Chairman and
Senator Murphy.
Sieben, the $100 cost that is paid to the contractor, there's a very small profit margin there. So it's, it's a technology-based piece of equipment, the large overhead costs, and then the labor cost to, put the device in and, give the people the training that's needed so that they can operate it properly. But it's, and the vendors want to be competitive, and as Ms. Marty said earlier, there's all kinds of these competitors in the state. Their average cost is all around $100. I mean, so they're not going to get rich on this, but they'll be able to make a little bit of money, so, and stay in business. And I'm not too worried about, $20 or $25 here or there, to tell the truth, Senator Sieben, on this $100, provision. I'm more worried about making sure that those families that decide to go on this program can get in and make sure that they can still, you know, have the freedoms that Senator Olson was talking about earlier. The other thing it does is, for the offender, we know now they're not going to be drinking and driving. And I think that that's the biggest benefit, is that you put somebody in one of these vehicles that has the interlock in it, and you are 100% certain that they're not going anyplace if they've been drinking. That's the benefit to society that I don't think we can hang a number on.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Stephen.
I'm supportive of the overall intent of the bill. I just want to make sure that the $100, you know, I have heard that it seems a little bit high, and I just want to make sure that we're getting, as a state, as DVS and other departments are faced with decreasing budgets, that the state's getting the best deal possible out of it. That's my concern.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Stephen, I understand that, and there's more advanced technologies that would probably cost a little bit more. You know, if you put in the in the adapter so that you can take a picture of the driver every so often to make sure that the person actually blowing in the tube is the one that is the one on the program, instead of handing the tube to, you know, your 14-year-old daughter in the back seat and having her blow in it for you. So there are different levels of technology that can be plugged into here. And, you know, with the pilot, with the success of the pilot project, you know, I feel pretty comfortable about moving ahead at this time with this type of technology. And in the years to come, it's going to be your all's decision of whether or not to, you know, start enhancing some of this technology with the camera on the driver and some of these other devices that can be plugged into this unit.
I'm not sure who can answer this, probably Ms. Marty. But, it sounds like for every vehicle, it's $100 a month. Personally, I have three vehicles and an antique car, or a classic car. I would not intend to drive that classic car, so I would be required probably to put the device on three cars. And now if I do drive that classic car, and, for instance, I get stopped for not wearing a seatbelt, and now I'm driving a car that does not have the monitor on it, it sounds like there's a that's a misdemeanor violation. Is that a moving violation, and does that affect my ability on the program?
Senator Carlson, while they're deliberating on that, I would suggest that you not drink and drive so that you have to have any of that kind of cost.
Well, see, I'm not driving now because I would have the seatbelt violation, you see.
No, don't drink and drive so that you get the interlock in there in the first place. That's my point.
If my wife does it, okay.
Upon further review.
Mr. Chair and members, if an individual is driving a vehicle without the ignition interlock device, because that restriction that they are to drive with an ignition interlock system is on their license, it would be considered a moving. It's a violation of the restriction. That's what it is.
It's a misdemeanor.
And it's a misdemeanor charge.
Okay. And moving misdemeanor.
Not moving. I'm sorry. It's just a violation of the restriction. So it's not a moving violation, but a violation of the restriction.
All right. Okay. Thank you. Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just 45 seconds of history here. When I was a young girl, two of my favorite things to do was to climb trees and to read books. And I often would ride my bike to a little park where I would climb a tree and read a book. And one day I was coming home and I was late, and although I knew that I was supposed to get off my bike and walk my bike across an intersection, I stayed on my bike and was hit by a drunk driver who knocked me into the middle of a busy intersection. Since that time, I've been pretty sensitive to drunk driving incidents, and when I was a naive and idealistic legislator in the House, introduced ignition interlock legislation and passed the first plate impoundment bill. I think that in some ways I'm still naive, but I'm not particularly idealistic anymore. However, I can't tell you how much this legislation means to me personally.
Thank you, Senator Ross.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize for coming in and out, but I think you all know there are so many visitors at the Capitol today. So if I missed this question, and you've already answered it, please forgive me. But what happens with the reinstatement fees that we currently charge? Will they be charged for these revocations? And if you're not going to be charging the reinstatement fees, how will these dollars be used to fill that revenue gap?
Mr. Chair and Senator Ortman, well, as you know, the reinstatement fee, DVS only gets a portion of the reinstatement fee. And so that part of the reinstatement fee will come, and it goes into our driver services special revenue account. The rest of the money, there's some of it that goes to the brain trauma fund.
Right.
There's money that goes to the general fund to help pay for the BCA testing that needs to occur and the lab costs for doing the testing. And so the money will still come to us, because even if you're going to participate in this program, you first have to get reinstated. So you're not, if we were just writing a limited license to you so that you could, you know, do your go to work and back and go to treatment or AA meetings, then we don't get a fee for issuing a limited license. But instead, now we would be getting the reinstatement fee right off, you know, right before they start the ignition interlock program, and they get a new driver's license, and on that driver's license it will state on the back, there's a section that says restrictions, that would be a restriction so that law enforcement knows that they are participating in the ignition interlock program. So those costs should be covered by that reinstatement fee, but they'll be paying it so that they can have those full driving privileges while they're on ignition interlock.
Mr. Chair, if I could follow up.
Senator Ortman.
If you could just remind us, how much is the reinstatement fee? I know some of it goes elsewhere, but then I'm not here to defend anybody with a DWI. What I'm getting at is how much are then we charging folks to get back on the road? They have to pay their reinstatement fee, and then we're talking about $100 per month. And we have had some testimony in some of our committees about from folks who have said it is so cost prohibitive when this happens that they can't get back to work because they can't afford it. And so I think we do have to look overall at what these costs will be to folks. So you're talking about $1,200 a year for the interlock, but then you're going to add on to that the reinstatement fee.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ortman, well, first of all, the fee is $680. As you know, a few years ago, you passed legislation that if you were not able to pay, you were could meet the definition of indigency that the public defender sets, that then we would allow you to have a partial payment plan with DVS so that you could pay it over a period of time. Then also, if in this legislation there is an indigent fund that will be established that will allow people who are indigent to pay up to half, they would pay up to half of the costs of it. And the vendor, we have to write rules that would allow for the use of the, of setting up the procedures for the indigent fund. That's how it's described in the bill. And so there would be funding that would be available for people that could meet those requirements to be defined as such, so that they would be able to still participate if they weren't able to have the finances to be able to accomplish that on their own.
Thank you.
Senator Murphy, I have a question from the staff here. Do you happen to know how many drinks a .15 equates to?
Mr. Chairman, .15, you know, once again, it depends on who the person is, what their drinking history is, how much they weigh, what their body fat is. I mean, there's a lot of different, they're saying seven or eight drinks.
Depending on all the variables,
two that you just mentioned.
Yeah. Depending on those variables of height, weight, age, sex. I mean, it's everybody's metabolic rate is different. You know, if you've eaten, it's a different. If you're drinking on an empty stomach, I mean, everybody knows if you want to get really sloshed, you pound three beers down on an empty stomach and you're going to get buzzed right away. But you can't get buzzed on three beers if you have a steak dinner beforehand.
I can.
Well, I could too. I haven't had a drink in 20 years. I'd probably have two sips and tip over. But no, it's different for everybody, Senator. And the State Patrol, and I'm not exactly sure if they do this anymore, but they used to run these classes where they would invite some of us out. You still do this?
Still do.
They would invite some of us out, and then, you know, we could be kind of crash test dummies, sign up, have a couple drinks. They'd let you drive through the course. You know, they videotape what you do, record everything, and then show you how you did after the program. And you can see, you know, somebody has one drink. This is no kidding. If you have one drink, you drive differently. Okay, with one drink. You have a half dozen drinks, and you drive substantially different than you normally would. And if you have a 12-pack, well, if you can find the key slot, you're doing pretty good after a 12-pack. But
And no, Senator Murphy, you have two more testifiers,
yes, two more
so
witnesses.
Perhaps we should move along. We have Karen Spratler from Mothers Against Drunk Driving and Steve Holmgren, First District Public Defender. Ms. Spratler, please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the Senate Transportation Committee. My name is Karen Spratler, and I am a volunteer for MAD Minnesota, serving on the State Operations Council and as a member of the Public Policy Committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak before you today. Since 1980, MAD has been at the forefront of the battle to stop people from making the choice to drink and drive. Over the last 30 years, MAD has fought to change and revise laws, educate the public, and to provide victim advocacy services for those who need help in the process of recovery. It's MAD's mission to stop drunk driving. Our campaign to eliminate drunk driving includes four key strategies, one of which is the implementation of alcohol interlock technology to stop impaired driving. MAD believes that anyone who violates the public trust by driving at or above a .08 BAC deserves and needs an alcohol ignition interlock device. The main reason why people continue to drink and drive in today's world, despite almost 30 years of intense public education and efforts of law enforcement, is because they can. Considering that approximately 75% of those whose licenses are suspended or revoked after driving under the influence, they continue to drive without that license, we know that revoking a license is not enough. Ignition interlock technology is a critical part of the solution because these devices effectively separate people who have been drinking from operating their motor vehicles, thereby improving public safety for all roadway users. Research is clear that ignition interlocks are very effective for both first-time and repeat DWI offenders. Interlock devices have been shown to reduce subsequent DWI offenses when they are installed on a vehicle by 50 to 90%. Some may argue that interlocks are too intrusive, but on the contrary, we believe interlocks strike a fine balance between taking an offender's license for a lengthy period of time and allowing them to drive legally. Surveys of New Mexico DWI offenders found that 85% of those offenders surveyed thought that an interlock was a fair sanction for DWI offenses. An interlock device in conjunction with an interlock restricted license and recommended treatment will allow an offender to legally drive and fulfill work, family, and other responsibilities. MAD strongly supports the efforts of Senate File 2741 to enhance administrative penalties for drivers testing at .15 BAC and higher. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration reports that drivers with a .15 BAC and higher are at least 20 times more likely to be involved in a fatal crash than a sober driver. And about two-thirds of all fatally injured drinking drivers have BACs of .15 or higher. Ignition interlock technology gives both DWI victims and DWI offenders hope. Victims, that DWI drivers can no longer drive after drinking, and for offenders, that they can learn to live their lives without incurring the costly and tragic consequences that drinking and driving too often brings. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Spratler. Mr. Holmgren, please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Steve Holmgren. I'm the Chief Public Defender in the 1st Judicial District. I represented the Board of Public Defense on the Minnesota Driver's License Administrative Policy Group, the group that you heard referred to earlier. And I'd like to first of all say that our group supports the idea of ignition interlock. We see it as a realistic approach to the demands of people in the modern world. I think we all recognize that folks need to drive to get to work, to school, to treatment, those types of things. And this is a realistic approach, I think. But to be effective, we also recognize that it needs to be fairly administered and that it needs to be equally accessible to people. I think there's an underlying assumption here that to be effective, this program is going to require widespread participation. And our concern is particularly involves not only the indigent folks, but the working poor. Now, the bill does provide a provision that directs the Commissioner of Public Safety to establish some sort of a indigent fund or perhaps reduced rate for indigent persons. But our concern is that that hasn't been spelled out. We don't particularly know what those fees are going to be. And all of this has to be taken and looked at in context of the fees that folks right now are already paying. In addition to a $680 reinstatement fee, folks convicted of DWI are paying fines, surcharges, pay-to-stay fees for jail time, booking fees, probation fees, a host of other fees that go along with pretrial monitor and those type of things. And another significant obstacle, and I don't know that it's been mentioned today, is the fact that folks are going to need to become insured to be able to qualify for this program. So our concern really is just the fact that, you know, we applaud the idea of this, but we would like to see the details fleshed out more so. Because we're really concerned that the working poor and the indigent are able to take advantage of the program.
Mr. Chair? Senator Rolstein.
Yeah, Mr. Holmgren, you struck me with that comment about that people will have to become insured. I mean, that's a kind of a big deal with this committee. And we would expect that people would have insurance when they drive on the road. I do have a question in regards to my understanding of this bill is this is on the implied side or the consent side. So people don't use your office for this then, correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator. Our office is not directly involved in the administrative sanctions. That's correct. We do, however, represent these people in the criminal end of things. And we also see these same persons back when they violate by getting charged with driving after cancellation, driving after suspension, driving after revocation. So the courts, public defense in general, I think, have a very big interest in seeing this type of program succeed. Hence our concern for the poor and the working poor.
General team.
Do you think one reason people go the implied route is to save legal fees and all that kind of stuff down the road, or?
Mr. Holmgren.
Mr. Chair. Senator, I'm not sure what you mean by the implied route. What generally will happen is, I can tell you from my experience that our clientele will not contest a driver's license revocation typically. They don't have the wherewithal to file an implied consent petition. So they don't contest the revocation. And even if they were to win or be found not guilty of a DWI offense, they're still revoked and have to deal with that and would have to participate in this program. So I'm not sure if I answered your question, but.
Just that there's two paths to go, the criminal side or the.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Mr. Holmgren.
Senator. You have to do both. You have to do the criminal side. If you're charged, you have to participate in that. And if you are wealthy enough or if you have the resources to be able to hire counsel or perhaps be pro se, I don't know how many people will do that, you could file an implied consent petition and actually try to contest the revocation that way. So the criminal path is mandatory. The administrative revocation to contest that is. is optional, but you still have to deal with the consequences of the revocation, even if you choose not to contest it.
Mr. Holmgren, the similar question as I asked before, do you think that because now there is a driving option or an easier driving option, do you think that there'll be less resistance to a conviction?
You know, that's a very difficult question to answer. We discussed that quite a bit of detail in our committee hearings, and one of the interesting dynamics now is that on a first-time DWI offense, if you plead guilty, you're eligible to get your driver's license back within 30 days. And from my personal experience, I couldn't begin to say in general that that's a huge factor for many first-time offenders, DWI offenders. They want to get that driver's license back. As I understand this bill, that option's not going to be there anymore for them. So it may very well, in my opinion, make people less inclined to want to resolve the case right away.
Senator Sieben.
Mr. Chair and Senator Murphy, I was thinking more about your response to the $100 a month program costs that were outlined in the presentation. And Krista pointed out that it doesn't specify that in the bill. It just says that the program participant shall pay the costs associated with the interlock device. So the statute isn't going to say it's $100 per month. So what I'm wondering is if you'd be willing to work with me to come up with some sort of language where there's the understanding that there's still the $100 a month cost, but out of that $100, there's some slight fee built in to that $100 that would go either towards paying the costs associated with of coverage for people who need counsel, like the judge talked about, or for increased monitoring for the state patrol. I just sort of feel pretty strongly that we need to get a little bit better deal from the vendors in this case. And I understand they may not be making a lot of money, but I think that instituting a program like this, there are also costs that are absorbed by the state or local units of government that we should be mindful of and perhaps at least try to make a small effort to recoup some of those costs.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sieben, that's not a problem.
Senator Murphy.
We can work on that, see if we can come up with anything.
Thank you.
Ms. Berzovsky has some of the language in there that she would like to tell us about.
Well, Mr. Chair, I was just trying to understand when the department said there's going to be an indigent fund, because I only found on 10.29 to 10.31, it says the commissioner shall require manufacturers of certified devices to provide installation, servicing, and monitoring to indigent program participants at a discounted rate. So it seems like the legislation is drafted already to ask the manufacturers to, to support or subvene the costs of indigent participation. But I don't think there's any other fund established in the legislation. So there already is something kicked in by the manufacturers, I guess, is contemplated by this legislation.
Mr. Chairman and Ms. Berzovsky, this issue of the indigent fund came up earlier. And, here's Ms. McCormick.
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair, and the issue would be that, you know, if you look at the legislation that Bonnie was addressing, that it talks about that we would be establishing program guidelines. So the authority to put that in our guidelines is what we have in this bill at the current time. But that was the intent, is that we would set up requirements that the vendors would have to meet in order to help pay for those costs. But it may not be as specific as what the committee is looking at. But that is the intent.
Mr. Chair? on that point, if I might?
Senator Dahl.
I just wanted to find out how often are we going to, that will they review those processes? And it's my understanding when we do these things is we put them in the statute and then they don't get revisited often enough and market conditions can change and things like that. I was just curious if there's a setup for that.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Dahl, it's my understanding that the department wanted to keep coming back and telling us how the program was working, but you know, we can put some language in here that would direct them to do that on an annual or basis if that sounds good. Because I think that would be a good thing to do. But I know that they were wanting to compile those statistics anyway because, you know, you have to track a program to see how successful it is. And if this overall statewide program is as successful as the pilots, I think everybody's going to be pretty happy. This goes back to the implied consent hearings. This bill is actually going to reduce some of those because people aren't going to need to go back to court to get their license. You know, part of the problem that we have with our DWI laws in the state of Minnesota is that not just the DWI laws, but some of the other traffic laws that we have, they're kind of clogging up our court system. And the more that we can take this and make it an administrative process, the less has to happen inside the court. You know, we need to be very considerate of the court's time. They've had one budget cut after another, and, you know, we're depending on them to put rapists and murderers and muggers and thuggers and thieves behind bars. And, you know, maybe they shouldn't be dealing with the DWI folks as much until they get to that third, fourth, fifth, 20th DWI, and then put them in the Crossbar Motel and throw the key away.
And Mr. Chair and
Senator,
Senator Murphy, it's because when I heard that we have 40,000, you know, convictions annually under the current program, I mean, that's pretty disturbing. And if we can, you know, and only 40% are, you know, second time or repeat offenders out of that's a lot of new entries into the system. And hopefully this will bump that up to 80%, you know, instead of 40%, because, yeah, we need to reduce the number somehow.
Yeah. And, Mr. Chairman, Senator Dahl, you know, some of the other added benefit, I think, is not only the point that you bring up that we'll be, you know, hopefully getting more people into the Interlock program, you know, which ensures that they're safe on the road, or at least sober on the road. It's not only that, but it's the long-term benefit that happens after that. You know, if we get to, you know, and this is just kind of the treatment philosophy in general, is that the earlier that you can get to somebody in their drug or alcohol craze, the more successful you're going to be long-term in getting it turned around. You know, and I think that this is going to be perfect for that situation. I also see this, you know, long term, it's going to save people money. It's going to save people money inside their own family budgets. It's going to, you know, take a little bit of the heat off the court system. I just think it's a good program all the way around. And, you know, I'm glad that the department and the, you know, governor asked me to try it through the legislature.
Any other questions from the committee? I guess I agree with you, Senator Murphy. This is really another step in that change of culture. I think from, you know, I don't think we need to rehash what it was like when we were people that are my age were younger. There was a lot more immortality I think we gave to ourselves than was actually the fact, and. This is something that has been needed for a long time, and I think what we need to do is change our culture such that it's not something to boast about when we get picked up drunk driving or if we don't get picked up drunk driving. So I appreciate that you're willing to carry this, and it's a very good thing.
Well, Mr.
Is
Chairman,
there any? Pardon me. Go ahead, Senator Murphy.
Well, this question is for Ms. Berzosky. Do we need to make any changes, or we have made any changes to the contents of the bill today? And we have no amendments?
It's perfect as is. Do we have anyone in the audience?
That would be a first for me. Maybe not these folks, but it would be a first for me. But, Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate File 2741 be recommended, pass, and re-refer to the Committee on Judiciary.
Thank you, Senator Murphy. I want to ask first, is there anyone in the audience who would testify against, in opposition? Seeing no one running up, Senator Murphy renews his motion to recommend Senate File 2741 and be forwarded to the Committee on Judiciary. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Mr. Chairman, we'll see you back at 6 o'clock, right?
Yes. We will adjourn this meeting and
recess.
We will...
Recess.
I'm sorry. We will recess this meeting and reconvene at 6 o'clock in room 107. 6 o'clock tonight, 107. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.